squealed for a second before the Humvee launched forward. One of the soldiers fired a burst of gunfire that ricocheted off the vehicle and cracked the windshield. "Down!" Fitz yelled. He ducked as they smashed into two soldiers, their bodies crunched under the tires. The other two Chimeras continued firing, bullets riddling the back of the Humvee. The gate arm snapped as Fitz blasted through it and took them into the alley. He swerved onto a street, then drove straight down Pike Street. Variants took to the road in pursuit, galloping on all fours. Some jumped out in front of the Humvee, but Fitz kept his foot on the gas. The heavy vehicle flattened them, hardly even jolting over each beast. Fitz swerved past debris and charred vehicles until he got to an open stretch. He pushed the pedal down again, accelerating away. Bullets pinged against the Humvee as Chimera soldiers stormed the street from CECO. He took a right turn. A clang on top of the Humvee caused him to duck. A variant pried open the hatch on top. Dohai brought his rifle up and fired. The surgical glue had come loose, and more blood trickled through his fatigues, but Fitz kept driving. He took side streets, doing anything he could to throw the Chimeras and their beasts off his tracks. His heart finally started to calm when he saw Smith Cove Park. He drove straight over the curb and only slowed to a stop in the overgrown grass when they reached the tree where they had hidden their boat. Dohai leapt out and sprinted to the rib, then dragged it toward the water. Ace lumbered over, favoring his right leg, as he took Corin with him. Fitz followed, his muscles protesting with every step.
"On our six,"
Ace yelled as Dohai shoved the boat into the water. Fitz went to a knee, joints protesting at the movement. He sighted up a monster lunging from behind them in the moonlight and squeezed the trigger. Rounds blasted through the wart-covered face. It tripped over its own limbs, sliding across the grass. Two more creatures bounded around it. Dohai started the rib's motor, and Ace pushed Corin over the gunwale before stumbling in himself. Fitz picked off the two remaining creatures, riddling them with three bullets each. He lowered his gun and hobbled over to the boat, sliding over the side.
"Let's get the fuck out of here," he said.
Dohai motored away from the shore as other creatures swarmed toward their position, running on all fours from the surrounding streets. A few jumped into the water, trying to swim after them, their armored flesh reflecting the moonlight. But with the boat going full throttle, they couldn't keep up. Fitz took a long, deep breath. Ghost had escaped CECO, thanks to Dohai's heroic efforts, and now, with Corin's capture, they had the crucial evidence they needed for General Kamer and anyone else who questioned the evil here. A single look at the Chimera was a powerful reminder that this war wasn't for the fate of the Allied States. Even General Kamer would have to recognize what an army of these creatures could do to Canada. 25. The drive to Mount Katahdin had taken less time than Timothy had anticipated. He chalked that up to driving well above normal, safe speeds, making it in a little over 7 hours. The only time they stopped was to fill up with the gasoline they had taken from the ambushed convoy. Wearing night vision goggles had helped him navigate the dark route. Ruckley had dozed off for part of the ride. Timothy didn't blame her, given her injured arm. She was wide awake now, staring through the windshield. Fresh bandages covered her injuries, but with all the muscle damage, she couldn't even lift her rifle. By the time Timothy saw the mountain in the moonlight, it was nearly 3:30 in the morning. "Why don't I see any fire?" she asked. "The military should have leveled this place by now." Timothy eased off the gas. The tires crunched on the wet, rocky country road.
"They got our message," Ruckley said. "You sure that is Mount Katahdin?"
"Yes," Timothy said. The images of his time underground here and his captivity were seared into his memory. The two corporals, Winslow and Carey, offered no explanation.
"Maybe they're still preparing an attack," Ruckley tried.
"We radioed it in like 6 hours ago," Timothy said. "They could have leveled this place if they wanted."
Ruckley squirmed, a grimace on her face under the NVGs.
"I don't think it's a question of if they wanted to or not. What if they couldn't?"
The implications chilled Timothy to his core.
"She's right," Winslow said. "There might not be any aircraft left. God, for that matter, maybe there isn't anyone left to take this place out."
He said what they all didn't want to admit. But Timothy knew it wasn't entirely true.
"I'm still breathing,"
And I see three soldiers who can still fight, Timothy said. If it's only us, then so be it. I'm ready to destroy this place.
Ruckley let out a half snort. I wish I could have met your old man. Guy must have been one tough son of a bitch and a hell of a warrior to have a son like you.
He was, Timothy said. Like our new friends.
Glancing in the rearview mirror, he looked at Winslow and Carrie. The bearded men were battle-scarred veterans. Not only had they served in the First War, but they'd been deployed to Afghanistan before the variants had surged across the earth.
Y'all ready? Ruckley asked.
Two nods from the back seat.
Pull off ahead, Ruckley said. Let's take the rest of the way on foot.
Timothy slid the truck between the trees, ensuring their parking spot was well concealed, then killed the engine. All four hopped out and began hiking into the woods. Winslow and Carrie took the lead with Timothy in the middle and Ruckley hanging back. She was armed with only an M9 and a few hand grenades. Taking cautious steps, Timothy swept his NVGs back and forth over the trees. He thought back to his captivity, trying to remember anything that might give him a clue how to get into the base. While he hadn't spent much time outside the base without a blindfold, he remembered the camouflaged staging area where the collaborators had taken him when they launched their mission to destroy Outpost Portland. Back then, he had studied his surroundings to try to figure out where he was. If he could just recognize the same view he'd seen that night, then he could lead the group into one of the base's entrances. The trek out of the valley toward the mountain was painfully slow, especially with Ruckley. Timothy glanced over his shoulder, watching her injured gait. Her wounds weren't just slowing them down. They put the entire group at risk. The blood saturating her bandages would call any prowling variants from a mile away. Roving his rifle, he searched for any sign of motion. Rippling grass or the flash of pale flesh. He saw nothing out here. Maybe the beasts were too far tonight. Otherwise, he suspected they would have already attacked. The team went up a slope, boots squishing in the mud. Timothy was the first to crest the hill. He slipped through a maze of towering pine trees, the scent of their needles drifting on a cold wind. Carrie bent down a few feet away. Timothy stopped when the corporal motioned for the rest of the team. They gathered around his position, and he pointed to tracks in the mud. Most looked like they had come from boots, collaborator or military, Timothy couldn't tell. But there was one set of prints that appeared different from the others. Half the tracks were from a boot, and the other half was simply a flattened, square-shaped divot in the mud. Winslow and Carrie pushed on, but Timothy hesitated. He couldn't help but picture Fitz and Beckham. The strange print looked like it might have come from someone with a prosthetic. Those two might be alive somewhere in the States, but after everything that had happened, he doubted it. Even the experienced operators were no match for an enemy as ruthless and powerful as he had seen.
Keep moving, Ruckley said.
He walked next to her through the woods, still thinking of his old friends. When Timothy lived on Peaks Island, he had viewed Beckham and Horn as uncles. They had always looked out for him like he was part of their family. He had loved them. And he had thought they loved him too. But apparently he had been wrong. They had abandoned him the night Outpost Portland was hit by collaborators. Remembering the past reminded Timothy of something his father used to say. Anger eats our insides like cancer. You need to learn to let it go. His dad had told them that when Timothy was upset with Bo over some stupid thing he couldn't even recall. Now his dad and Bo were both gone. Anger had done nothing to fill the void they had left behind. His dad was right. Timothy needed to let go of his anger. He needed to forgive Beckham and Horn. They hadn't killed his dad. In fact, they had saved his dad and him almost a decade ago, risking their own lives for people they didn't even know. He was no longer the naive child who thought they would just leave him at Portland for no good reason. They couldn't possibly have known what would happen to him. Instead of ascribing his rage to Beckham and Horn, he focused on who really deserved it. The collaborators. He hurried to keep up with the other three soldiers.
Not 10 minutes later, they discovered another set of tracks, a single set of shoe prints headed in nearly the opposite direction of the first tracks. These looked fresh, which meant there might be patrols or snipers out here. Timothy moved his finger to his trigger, ready to blast the first one he saw. They soon reached a rocky overlook. Timothy started to walk toward the side with Ruckley, but she halted and knelt. He dropped beside her to examine a body. It was a man in a ghillie suit, a bullet hole in his neck and cheek. In rigor mortis, he still held a sniper rifle aimed at the valley where they had parked below.
"Someone's here after all," Winslow said.
"Thank God for that," Carrie said. "This guy would have had the drop on us."
Ruckley nodded. "You think the military sent in a tactical team instead of bombing the place?"
"I hope so," Winslow said.
"If they did, wouldn't we hear voices or gunshots?" Timothy asked.
Then he got a sick feeling in his gut when he started to answer his own question.
"Unless we already lost the fight."
Ruckley exhaled, her breath misting.
"If that's true, we shouldn't follow the same tracks the other strike force did," Carrie said. "We need a different way in."
"Agreed," Ruckley said, beginning to retreat. Timothy looked over the ledge. He noticed a flat area where swaths of trees seemed to have been cut down in the distance. When he squinted, he thought he could see some kind of camouflage netting draping over where the trees had been. It struck him then. This was the area above the chambers where he had been kept with the other prisoners, and those trees had been destroyed by bombs.
"Hey, hold up," Timothy said. "I think that's where they held me prisoner."
Carrie scoped the section of burned forest.
"There's a back way into the facility from there," Timothy said. "I remember it well. Plus, the bombs left holes in the ceiling. There might be more ways in."
Winslow looked for a way down. He found one a moment later and motioned for the team to follow him down the steep hill. At the bottom, they continued through the dense forest. A chill ran through Timothy as they got closer to the chamber. Memories of the horror came back to him. The dead bodies, the variants, feeding. Timothy pressed his rifle against his shoulder. He stayed close to Ruckley. She had taken point, and Winslow and Carrie were on rear guard to cover their tracks. 15 minutes into the march, she held up a hand at the edge of the forest. Creaking tree branches sang through the cold morning like a gust of wind had suddenly swept through the woods. But Timothy only saw the rustling branches in a slight breeze. Ruckley paused beside him, both scanning the white trees and the green hue of their optics for contacts. A cracking sounded behind them. Timothy checked over his shoulder to look for Winslow and Carrie. His heart sunk. Both men were gone.
"Sergeant," Timothy whispered.
His shaking voice caught when he saw a flash of white dart between the trees.
"Ruckley," he whispered again.
He didn't dare glance over his shoulder to make sure she had heard him. He focused solely on the woods where the seemingly camouflaged variant had flanked them.
Was this the only one out there? Had it taken both corporals alone?
Heart pounding, Timothy aimed his rifle over the shadowy forest. Still, he saw nothing. The beast had vanished like a ghost. A hand clenched his shoulder and he flinched, biting the inside of his cheek.
"When I say run, you run," said Ruckley.
Timothy gave a nod. Before she could give the command, figures seemed to melt out of the trees, their eyes glowing. Half of the camouflaged beasts moved on all fours over the ground. Others leapt between branches. Timothy counted 10, but there had to be more. There was no way to win this fight, and running wouldn't get them far. The creatures closed in. Lips popped and joints cracked. He heard the noises from behind him and Ruckley. He knew that as soon as he squeezed the trigger, they would all rush him, tearing him into ribbons. Pulling the trigger would also alert the collaborators to their position.
"What do we do?"
Timothy asked. There must be a way out. Some way to save themselves. Ruckley pressed her back against his. She gave her only answer by firing a gunshot. Timothy fired a burst from his rifle, blowing off the top of a skull.
"Run!"
she shouted. He turned and bolted after her, dodging past a pair of swiping beasts. He let his rifle fall on its sling and held it against his body with one hand. With the other, he pulled out his pistol. He needed as much speed as he could get. They raced for the clearing where the prison chambers were. Beasts ran alongside them, darting around the trees. He let loose a few rounds to keep them back. Bullets punched into trees and flesh, splintering bark and bone. Angry howls pierced the night. Timothy sucked in deep breaths, his lungs burning. They were almost to the chamber. He could see the hole in the ground. Turning, he fired at a beast galloping to catch up. A bullet punctured its shoulder, driving into its chest. The monster tumbled into a bed of pine needles. Ruckley screamed as a beast tackled her. It hopped up and dragged her away from the pack and into the woods at a remarkable speed.
"Ruckley!" he yelled.
"Run!" she screamed back. And then she was gone, her cries escaping from wherever it must have taken her underground. Timothy ran over the splintered trees and ravaged landscape. Three variants cut him off from going after Ruckley. Moments later, the ground shook once, then twice. The explosions were coming from underground, and his heart sank. Maybe that was Ruckley setting off her grenades, sacrificing herself to stop the monsters. He was truly alone now. His head swiveled as he searched for an escape. Finally, he spotted another beast running for a hole in the ground where moonlight flooded a chamber. "There," he thought. He sprinted toward it, his muscles screaming for oxygen, his body at its limits, his mind still trying to wrap around what had happened to Ruckley. The variants circled between the fallen and shredded trees, trying to surround him as he neared the hole. But they were hanging back now, almost like they were afraid of this place. He stopped, sucking in air to catch his breath as he watched the beasts cautiously prowl the perimeter. They stayed close to the cover of the trees and rocks, saliva dripping from the corners of their sucker lips.
"Lower your weapon," came a voice.
A group of four men in fatigues appeared from behind the trees surrounding the entrance to the chamber. All carried machine guns, and they were all pointed at Timothy. He prepared to fight back when he recognized a man with dreadlocks. It was Pete. The leader walked over with a gun aimed at Timothy. Another man Timothy recognized joined him. Nick, the manipulative asshole, and Pete's right-hand man.
"Lower your weapon," Nick said.
Timothy's heart kicked. This was his chance. He could kill them both here and now. Sure, he would die too, but he would get his revenge. What he couldn't do was stop the nuke. Countless innocent people would perish. Then again, when they realized who he was, they would probably kill him anyway. It was now or never. He brought his pistol up to fire. A bullet slammed against his chest before he could squeeze the trigger. Shock dulled his senses, and he dropped to his knees. The pistol fell from his grip. He looked down at his chest, patting it and wheezing, until he felt the hole in his vest. Red crept over his vision. He tried to suck in a breath, but his lungs felt like mush, exploding with agony when he did. A pair of boots stomped toward him and kicked away his gun. Then someone bent down and pried off his night vision goggles.
"I'll be damned," said Nick.
"What?" Pete asked.
"You gotta see this," Nick replied.
Two faces hovered over Timothy. He could smell their breath, and he tried to reach out, to choke one maybe. But he was too weak, the pain too much to fight back. He slumped over, still gasping.
"Well, shit. The world's way smaller than I thought," Pete said. "The new gods really blessed us tonight. Not only do we have Captain Reed Beckham, but now we got the prick kid who betrayed us."
"Let Timothy go," Beckham stammered.
Slung up on a concrete wall, he was suspended in a mixture of the slimy glue from the variants and webbing. Nick couldn't believe it. The famous heretic and traitor Captain Reed Beckham had walked right into their clutches, and the young guy who Nick had thought died in Outpost Portland had wandered back too, all in the same night. Even crazier, the two traitorous assholes knew each other. The sound of a chopper thrummed in the distance.
Nick looked up through the jagged moonroof in the chamber ceiling as a little bird crossed the moon. The general had called off his trip early and was returning to their master. It was no longer safe for him at Katahdin now that this location had been compromised. Soon, Nick and his comrades would follow. The general's business here was finished anyway, but there were still some things to wrap up before Nick and Pete left.
"Let him go," Beckham said. "My life for his."
Nick smiled as Timothy bucked against his restraints. The kid was secured next to the famous Captain Reed Beckham and his ginger best friend, Master Sergeant Parker Horn. Another operator named Rico had joined them on the mission. Beside them, two male soldiers, Winslow and Carey, were imprisoned. The corpses of the other soldiers captured in the woods were on the cold ground or strung up on the wall. Not really corpses, mostly just spindly bits of gristle left on the gnawed-over bones. Nick appreciated that the military had sent foot soldiers instead of bombs. Bombs probably wouldn't have worked anyway, but this failed attack gave the followers of the new gods time to evacuate the facility and still launch their nuclear weapon. Plus, their corpses had kept their visitors and the thralls well fed. "You failed," Nick said to Beckham. "Do you know what happens now?" Beckham ignored him, looking at Timothy.
"I'm sorry," Beckham whispered. "I'm sorry we left you that night in Portland, Timothy. If only we could have known. I'm so sorry."
"Shut your fucking mouth, heretic," Pete said. He punched Beckham in the face. The impact cracked his nose, the sound echoing.
"I'm going to kill you both," Timothy said through clenched teeth.
Pete laughed.
"I'll give you credit for making it this far. But how are you going to kill any of us tied up like that?"
Nick studied the young man. His bulletproof vest had stopped a bullet meant for his heart. He was a lucky son of a bitch, and Nick was honestly surprised to see he had returned after Outpost Portland. Most sane people would have run and never looked back. But not Timothy.
"It's a shame," said Nick. "A kid with guts like yours would have made such a good soldier for the new gods."
He looked up at the hole at the top of the chamber. Four sets of yellow, hungry eyes stared down. The crouching thralls licked their sucker lips, anxiously waiting to feed on the captured soldiers the general and his guards had left. But Nick wasn't quite ready to give up these prisoners yet. This was too satisfying, finally pressing their heels against the faces of legends like Beckham and Horn, war heroes that had fought so long to sabotage their efforts.
"You wanted to know how we recognized you?" Nick said to Beckham. "How we knew where you and this big redneck asshole lived? We've been watching a very long time. It hasn't been nearly as hard as you might think."
Horn lifted his battered face. He let out a muffled curse behind the glue over his mouth.
"I've seen your daughters," Nick said to Horn. "Very pretty. I have two of my own, and they'll survive this war.
Unlike yours, it's truly a shame." Horn pushed against his restraints, his jugular bulging and his eyes going wild as a monster's.
"Don't worry," Pete chimed in. "Unlike yours, their deaths will be quick."
He snapped his fingers.
"Just like that. We're going to launch our nuke at President Ringo's little bunker. Your kids won't even know what hit them."
Nick folded his arms over his chest.
"You, on the other hand," Pete said, pointing at the prisoners. "You all will feel every bite."
Horn finally stopped struggling, his head sagging to his chest.
"I didn't really ever foresee this as the end for Captain Reed Beckham," Pete said. "Did you, Nick?"
"Nope," Nick said. "We watched, planned, and waited for our chance to strike back and destroy the Allied States. I never thought it would be you who came to us like a bug flying into a spider's web."
Beckham glared as they spoke.
"In all that time, while I watched and waited, I wondered."
Nick stepped closer and lifted Beckham's chin with his hand.
"I wonder why Captain Reed Beckham fought with the military and served an administration that had all but destroyed his life."
"You wouldn't understand," Beckham grumbled. You have no honor.
Honor is what losers cling to when they want to fool themselves into thinking defeat is acceptable, Nick said. Pete smiled at that and punched Beckham in the gut. Horn and the other prisoners squirmed like pigs, realizing they were being led to slaughter. Again and again, Pete hit Beckham. Nick watched, but his mind drifted to what was happening outside this chamber. The families were already being loaded onto a convoy for evacuation. He couldn't help but think about his wife, and despite it all, what Ray had told him. Voices broke him from his thoughts. A guard who had been holding sentry entered the chamber.
Sir, we're ready to evacuate on your order, he said.
Get started, Pete said. We'll be there soon.
The guard left, and Nick stepped up to Beckham. This was the hardened warrior who had led Team Ghost into Building 8 during the early days of the First War. His team was the first to bear witness to the result of the new VX-99 that the Medical Corps had created.
You have seen the worst of Mother Nature and man created by a corrupt government. But you still fight under the same banner, Nick said. You're defending the very people who made the things you think are evil. If you can't tell me why, then I guess we don't have anything left to discuss.
I'll let you explain your motives to the thralls as they feed on you.
We're wasting our time, Pete said. Come on, let's go.
Nick reached up with the remote that controlled the collars of the thralls, but Beckham opened his bloody lips.
Because freedom is worth fighting for. And you.
His eyes went from Nick to Pete, then to the beasts above.
You think you're saving the world by giving your allegiance to those things. You're nothing but their slaves. When they're tired of you, you'll end up like us.
Beckham coughed, blood-tinged spittle flying out of his mouth.
You're not saving humanity, Beckham continued. You're ending it. You're no better than Colonel Gibson, or any of the other war criminals who created VX-99 during Vietnam.
All this time you still don't understand, Nick snorted and walked away. The captain was a lost cause. He made his way down the row to Horn, then Rico. He stopped when he reached Timothy.
Sorry, kid. Wish this would have turned out different, Nick said. You had a lot of potential.
Nick and Pete left the room, leaving the prisoners unguarded. But that wasn't a concern. The shrieks of the variants blasted from the chamber as soon as they closed the door. Raising the remote, Nick clicked the button, releasing the thralls to feed. Then the two men hurried back through the halls until they reached an intersection. Nick stopped, and Pete grabbed his shoulder.
Focus, Nick. We've almost reached our goals, everything we've planned for. Forget about Diana and Ray. All that matters is the new gods.
Nick nodded.
Don't bother with her until we leave, Pete added. Promise me.
I promise.
That was a lie. He was absolutely dealing with his wife right now, because if she had indeed betrayed him, she wasn't leaving the mountain. He would leave her in this tomb with Ray's corpse forever. Pete ran toward the console where he would enter the launch codes. The powerful missile would launch straight toward the president's bunker in Long Island that some Allied scouts had discovered when they had seen Marine One flying to Lower Manhattan. Nick wasn't sure hitting command with the powerful nuke was the best use of it due to the size of the blast that would occur. But he wasn't in charge, and he had other things on his mind right now. He headed for his family through the empty halls to the garage. There, people were loading up into the trucks with the few remaining guards. They had lost more soldiers than Nick dared count in the surprise attack from the various strike groups. Some of the frightened people sobbed from the news of lost brothers, fathers, and sons, but Nick ignored them. His mind was dead set on only one thing. His wife and their daughters were in the back of the line with their bags. Nick grabbed Diana's arm and pulled her to the shelter of a doorway while his daughters called out.
I'll be there in a minute, Nick yelled back.
He took his wife through the door and shut it.
Nick, what's wrong? She asked.
Were you with Ray?
She squinted at him.
What do you mean?
Did you sleep with Ray?
She didn't answer, and he leaned in closer,
until their noses nearly touched.
"I'm only going to ask you once more," he said. "Did you sleep with Ray?"
She turned and went to the door, but he pushed his hand against it. She slowly turned toward him, tears welling around her eyes.
"He listened to me after you hit Freya, and he wasn't gone as much as you. It was wrong. I didn't want to."
Her gaze suddenly left his, and she cowered, mouth dropping open like she was afraid he would hit her too.
"Can't look me in the eye and tell me, huh?" he said.
"You can't." Footsteps clattered behind him. He turned to find a gun pointed at his face. Behind the barrel was Timothy. Another unfamiliar soldier with bandages over her arm stood beside him. She wasn't one of their prisoners.
"Don't fucking move, asshole," Timothy said.
"How?" he started to say.
"You should have made sure everyone was dead. Meet my friend Sergeant Ruckley."
"Your pets don't do well against grenades," Ruckley said. Behind her in the hall was Beckham, but Nick didn't see Rico or Horn.
"Listen, you can still join us," Nick said. "You can—"
"Don't say another goddamn word, you piece of shit." Timothy pressed the barrel against his temple, pushing his head slightly.
"Take me to the nuke."
"Go, Diana," Nick said, regret tinging his voice. He might not stand a chance, but revenge wasn't worth sacrificing his daughters for.
"Get the girls out of here."
"But do what your asshole husband says," Timothy said. As much as he despised his wife now, Nick was thankful Timothy was soft. His girls would need their mother if he died.
"Get the kids out of here," Nick snapped when she didn't move.
"You tell anyone you saw us and he dies," Timothy said. Diana opened the door and left before Nick could look at her one last time.
"Take us to the missile and I promise they'll leave safely," Timothy said.
Nick did as instructed, thinking only of his daughters now. They were the reason he had even answered the call on the radio that had led him to Pete and Katadin. Everything he'd done was for them, for a better future where they lived free from the tyranny of a diabolical government masquerading as a democracy intent on subjugating mankind. Sucking in a breath, he led them to a stairwell that he knew ended at a locked door. When they reached it, Ruckley moved past him and tried the door.
"It's locked."
Nick tried to come up with an idea to escape. Maybe he could push them down the stairs, just like he'd done to Ray, and make a run for it.
"Give us the key," Beckham said.
Nick reached into his pocket, pretending to fish around and buy some time. The cold metal of a gun barrel pressed against his head dispelled any notion of escape.
"You try anything stupid, and I'll splatter your brains all over," Timothy said. "Try me. I'd love to end you right now."
Without another option, Nick took out the key and handed it to Ruckley. She unlocked the door. Beckham raised his rifle, advancing as soon as the door cracked open. The operator fired two times, then kept his rifle pointed.
"Don't move," he said.
Timothy pushed Nick inside. Two officers lay sprawled face first on the floor. Pete stood in front of an office chair, his hands in the air. He glared at Nick, eyes burning with rage.
"The hell did you do, Nick?" he growled.
"The hell did you do?"
"Shut the fuck up," Ruckley said. She held a pistol with one hand, trying to steady it with the bandaged arm. Nick wasn't sure earlier how she had survived against the thralls, but his mistake had cost them all. Beckham pushed a comm piece up to his lips and spoke quietly. A few minutes later, Horn and Rico showed up panting. They explained the other soldiers were holding security and mopping up the final guards.
"You won't make it out of here," Pete said.
"Neither will you or your family," Beckham said. "Unless you give me the location of your other bases. Then we'll bring you in and you can live your life in a cell."
"Bring me in where?" Pete grinned. "You're delusional. You've lost this war, and I'll never—"
Rico shot him in the neck. He staggered backwards, blood gushing out as he reached up and then fell, knocking over the chair. He tried to speak, crimson bubbles popping from his mouth. He finally slumped to the floor. Nick swallowed hard as Rico pointed her gun at his chest. He was next,
and he knew it.
You just killed the only person that knows the other bases, Nick said, holding his hands up defensively.
Fine, I guess you and your family aren't worth anything to me either then, Beckham said. He nodded, and Timothy aimed the gun at his head again.
Wait,
Nick said. Tell me where they are, Beckham said. Tell us or your family gets to experience what it was like for all those people in Outpost Portland, all those kids, mothers, husbands, and neighbors who died because of you.
I don't know where all our bases are, Nick said. I do know a place where we turn men into warriors for the new gods.
Beckham narrowed his eyes. Warriors?
Half man, half variant, Nick said. Or what we call scions.
This was the intel the Allied States already had, according to allies out west who had told Pete and Nick about a military team that had infiltrated Seattle. Nick wouldn't dare give them something actually useful if he could help it.
What else? Beckham asked.
I don't know what else I can tell you. They keep us in the dark, every cell operating independently so we can't give each other up.
Beckham looked to Horn, who shrugged.
Okay, I believe you, Beckham said.
He nodded at Timothy.
For my dad, Timothy said.
He stowed his pistol and took out a knife. Stepping forward, he jabbed it in Nick's gut and twisted. He yanked it out and wiped the blood off on Nick's shirt. Then he put it back in the sheath and walked away as Nick grabbed his stomach and stumbled. Horn motioned to Beckham with one hand pressed to his ear as he stood over a console.
Command just gave me the authorization codes that will permanently disarm this whole base and the nuke. What do you say, boss?
End this fucking nightmare, Beckham said. Nick watched in horror as the big man entered the commands, watching the power drain from the base. He would never get to see the missile fly. Beckham, Horn, Rico, and Ruckley left the room without saying another word, leaving Nick to bleed out over the concrete floor, pain racking his insides. Their boots clanked down the stairs. Nick crawled toward the door, stopping briefly at Pete's corpse before continuing. His mind flashed with worry as his life pumped out of him, sloshing over the floor. The physical pain was nothing compared to the mental anguish of knowing he and Pete had lost. Somehow, despite all odds, despite all their planning, Captain Reed Beckham and a kid had beat them. Holding his slashed abdomen, Nick stumbled down the steps, leaning on the handrail. He almost fell to the landing where Ray had bled out and died. But Nick managed to make it back to the garage. His vision had blurred, but he could tell it was empty. His family was gone with the rest of the convoy. But then, through his fading vision, he saw someone had stayed behind. Maybe someone that could help him. It cleared enough to see it wasn't someone. Something. The thralls had returned. 10 of the beasts skittered into the room. He reached for his remote, but it was gone, lost somewhere in the facility, and these filthy creatures didn't have collars to control them. He fell to his knees and looked out the open garage to see the first rays of sunlight peek over the horizon. As the monsters narrowed in on him, waiting to strike, the light turned into bright blooms. This wasn't the sunrise. This was a bombing run. The convoy was being destroyed. 26. Waves rolled into the Galveston shore, sun glinting off the whitecaps and the afternoon glare. Razor wire top fences lined the beach, and soldiers patrolled the sand, leaving long trails of footprints. Compared to the shores of Peaks Island, this beach wasn't particularly scenic, but to Beckham it felt like paradise with his son and wife next to him. The fences and the raw firepower gave him hope that they were safe for now. But there was no time for strolls on the beach. Everyone had work to do in the war efforts that had brought them here. Beckham walked along a sidewalk away from the shoreline with his family. The path took them past boarded-up buildings and old hotels transformed into barracks. The base was alive with activity as soldiers marched between posts and vehicles chugged along the street to deliver crates of supplies. Kate squeezed his hand as Beckham winced from pain. The chimeras had beaten him good, leaving deep bruises across his body. The mission to Mount Katahdin had been a success, but it was one of only a few. He still didn't know the total number of outposts lost across the Allied states, or the total death count. And while the nuke had been stopped, the military was on the run. Vice President Lemke had set up a new central command in Puerto Rico, with General Souza and LNO Festa joining him there. It was no surprise that President Ringgold wasn't with them. He spotted her in the distance, standing at an airfield with an entourage of guards and soldiers.
"How long are we going to stay here?" Javier asked.
"I'm not sure," Kate replied.
"I kind of like it," Javier said.
Kate shared a look with Beckham. Her time in those humid tunnels had been its own grueling ordeal, and he knew she was thankful to be above ground, away from that nightmarish world for a while. But her work was far from over. Beckham didn't have the heart to tell his son that right now. Although, Javier was starting to understand his parents had chosen a lifetime of service to a calling greater than either of them. If men and women like them hadn't stepped up to defend this country, then the monsters would have won the first war.
"Hey, boss," Horn said.
He waved a big arm, jogging down the sidewalk to catch up. Tasha and Jenny led their two German shepherds on leashes, but Ginger and Spark pulled free when they saw Beckham and his family rushing toward the group with wagging tails and slobbering kisses. Horn scratched at his overgrown beard that hid some of his bruises and cuts. One of his eyes was swollen shut, and he limped over with a hand on his back.
"How are you feeling today, Big Horn?" Beckham asked. "Like I fought a gorilla and he beat the shit out of me, but I got in a few good licks against the son of a—"
Kate shot him a look, gesturing toward their son. Beckham held in a laugh. After everything they had endured, it was refreshing to cling to some sense of normalcy, even if it was just a failed attempt to shield Javier's ears from a curse word or two.
"Sorry, Javier," Horn said. "Let's just say I'm glad to be in one piece."
"Amen to that, brother," Beckham said. The familiar sight of S.M. Fisher's private plane came into focus. The jet was parked on the runway as the crew prepped it for its next flight. Silence hung over the group as they approached the side of the jet. A small group had already gathered beside the plane in a semicircle. Beckham spotted Ruckley right away with her arm wrapped up in clean bandages. Rico was here too, and jogged over to say hello. She had a big smile on her face now that she knew Fitz and the rest of Team Ghost were safe. Beckham gave Rico a hug, and so did Horn. The three Delta operators and their families stood back as President Ringgold and her staff prepared to honor a selfless patriot. General Cornelius stood nearby, the wind tugging at his white beard. Sergeant Sharp, a soldier who had fought with Fisher during the first days of the war, was also here to pay his respects. Beckham saw many familiar faces, but there was one missing. Timothy Temper. Everyone else had gathered here today to pay their respects to a man who the Allied States owed an enormous debt, a man who had been called out of a rather comfortable position heading a wealthy company both before and after the Great War of Extinction, Mr. S.M. Fisher. From what Beckham had learned, Fisher had sustained multiple injuries by the time Commander Amber Massey reached him at Battery Park in Lower Manhattan. She had promised the man he would make it back to Texas. And she had made good on that promise, delivering Fisher to an evac that got him to Long Island, where President Ringgold and the science team had taken him to Galveston. But despite round-the-clock medical care, even the strength Beckham had seen in Fisher wasn't enough to overcome the damage to his body. Now the cowboy oil tycoon was in a closed, narrow wooden box. "Everyone, please gather round," said President Ringgold. She waited for the group to form a circle around the casket. "Thank you all for joining us today," she continued. "S.M. Fisher impacted each and every one of us. He was a talented businessman who brought out the best in all those who worked for and with him. He had a storied career in ranching and oil. But the businesses that Fisher built with his own two hands isn't all that defined him. What defined Fisher was his devotion to protecting this country when Lady Liberty called for his assistance. He had every reason to run, and more than enough means at his disposal to hide somewhere safe, but he decided not to hide and not to run. He decided to fight." She shook her head, a sad smile on her lips.
By utilizing his knowledge of geoengineering and applying it to our defenses, he saved countless lives. Even in those last moments at Outpost Lower Manhattan, he stayed beside his men, doing his duty until the very end. His sacrifice and the sacrifice of his engineers and guards ensured that we had time to evacuate as many people as we possibly could. Ringgold looked over to another familiar face. Commander Massey from Outpost Lower Manhattan stood at the back of the crowd. She stepped forward, and Ringgold gave her a nod to speak.
I didn't know him long, but he was a kind man and a strong man, Massey said. The type of cowboy who would look a bull right in the eyes and send the bull running from him.
That got a couple of soft chuckles and a damn right from General Cornelius.
Thank you, Ringgold said. Now it is with great honor that I bestow Mr. S. M. Fisher with the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And it is my hope that he'll get to finally be at peace in his beloved Texas.
Beckham looked at the casket and the plane. He was told that General Cornelius was sending supplies out to Outpost El Paso, another place Fisher helped save. His remains would be laid to rest with his beloved wife in a cemetery outside El Paso, not too far from his old ranch.
Please take a moment and pray for him and the countless citizens and soldiers across the Allied states who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our country, Ringgold said.
A moment of silence passed as people bowed their heads to reflect and pray. She then brought the brief ceremony to a close, and one by one people went up to the improvised casket offering brief prayers. As the crowd dispersed, Ringgold joined Beckham and Kate. She said hello, but he could tell the president was ready to discuss business. A short walk and the celebration of life for Fisher was the only reprieve they would be getting.
Why don't you go play with the dogs a second? Kate said to Javier.
He bobbed his head and bounded off to where Tasha and Jenny were trying to keep Ginger and Spark occupied, playing fetch with the dogs. To Beckham's surprise, Ringgold gave Kate a hug, and then gave him a hug, too. He embraced her back, exchanging a glance with Kate while he did.
Your family gives me so much hope for this country, and seeing the kids like that gives me an idea of what our future looks like, Ringgold said. I look forward to the day we can go back to living in peace again.
We'll get there, Kate said.
I'm sure of it.
Me too, Beckham said.
I'm afraid we have a lot of work to do, Ringgold said.
What are the next steps?
Now that we've cracked the code of communicating through the variant network, I think we can make some real progress disrupting their plans, Kate said. I'm told there are some candidate sites around Houston that have direct webbing access, and I've already started making arrangements with my team.
Great. I have faith in you, Ringgold said.
Thank you, Madam President.
Captain Beckham, we've been relocating our defenses and routing evacuations to focus on the remaining 25 outposts we have, mostly concentrated in the southeast, from Florida to Texas, Ringgold said. I'm meeting with my advisors in a couple of hours, and I want you to be there.
Yes, of course, Madam President, Beckham said. Whatever you need.
In the meantime, spend time with the kids and try and get some rest, Ringgold said.
You'll need it.
Soprano and a couple of Secret Service agents whisked her away, her shoes tapping on the pavement back toward the center of the outpost. Kate grabbed Beckham's hand in her own.
What do you say we get something to eat with the kids in Big Horn?
Sounds great, Beckham said.
They started off back to Horn, the kids and the dogs, and then made their way back to the beach, where a row of food stands were serving seafood and other meals. Beckham paused when he saw a figure on the beach, not far behind one of the booths.
Give me just a minute, he said to Kate.
Okay, she replied.
Beckham hurried over to the sand, where he found Timothy standing alone, staring off over the waves past the chain-link fences and guard towers. The young man didn't look like the teenage kid he remembered from Peaks Island. His cut and bruised face was confident, like that of his deceased father, Jake Temper.
Mind if I join you? Beckham asked Timothy.
Timothy shrugged. For a few moments, they stood silently, taking in the view. Beckham had considered giving Timothy space in case he harbored ill will toward him after all that had happened, but there were some things that needed to be said.
I'll never forget the day I met you and your dad,
Beckham said. I had never seen anyone fight so hard against all odds like your father. Everything he did was to protect you. Timothy nodded. I didn't know Jake before the first war, but I'd bet my life he made a great police officer. Back on Peaks Island, there was no one else I would trust more to protect our community than your father. And that's why he stayed behind that night. To save you and the kids and my wife.
He was a brave, good man, Timothy said.
He was a brave, great man. And he would be proud of you beyond words. In fact, I am certain he is proud. You helped save my life at Mount Katahdin. And you also helped save countless others.
Someone had to do it.
Just because someone had to do it doesn't mean just anyone would. But you stepped up. You risked everything to stop the collaborators.
Timothy brushed away a tear with the back of his hand. I miss him. I miss my dad.
Me too, kid. Me too.
Beckham put an arm around Timothy, and Timothy didn't pull away.
I'm so sorry for leaving Outpost Portland that night, Beckham said. When we came back for you and you had gone off, I...
You came back for me?
Timothy looked over at Beckham, and he loosened his grip so he could face the young man. Yes, Horn and I both came back, and then we went out and looked for you, Beckham said. A team of collaborators hit our truck and killed our driver. Nearly killed us, too.
I didn't know.
How would you have known? All that matters is that we're here now, standing on this beach with a second chance to keep fighting.
I'll never stop, Timothy said.
Me either.
They embraced, and Beckham patted the kid on the back.
Your old man isn't the only one who's proud of you. I'm so proud, Timothy. And I think there might be an opportunity for you on Team Ghost.
Timothy brightened at that.
But first, let's eat, Beckham said. There's plenty of time for fighting. For now, let's spend some time with family.
Fitz woke up to find his ribs burning with every breath and his limbs scorching with electricity. He couldn't remember being in this much pain since he had lost his legs. Every muscle in his body felt like it was going to tear from his bones. With a gasping heave, he pushed his prosthetic blades over the side of his bed at the Banff Fairmont Hotel. They clanked against the timber floorboards as he made his way to the bathroom. There was still dried blood in the sink from earlier. He glanced at himself in the mirror. The bruises mottling his body had grown dark purple and blue, covering nearly every inch of exposed flesh. The cut on his chest was now covered in clean bandages and properly sewn up by the Canadian medics. Just another scar to add to his collection. Despite his pain, the past few hours of sleep had been one of the deepest in recent memory. In fact, he couldn't remember the last time he had slept in a bed like this. Now it was his turn to watch their prisoner and give Ace a chance to catch some shut-eye. When he, Ace, and Dohai had arrived with Corin, the first thing he'd wanted to do was to talk to General Kamer, not trade shifts watching the Chimera in a hotel room. He had been ready to give Kamer a piece of his mind and explain exactly why Canada needed to join the fight with the Allied States. But General Kamer had been called away in the night to Valmont, another Canadian frontier base, for a meeting with other military leaders. Apparently, the general was there to discuss provisions and supply routes before they settled in for the harsh winter. Fitz grabbed his rifle, left the room, and went a few doors down to where four Canadian soldiers stood outside. This particular room had been transformed into a holding cell for the Banff base. Team Ghost had told Kamer's men they wanted to personally stand guard over the Chimera. The Canadian soldiers hadn't seemed offended. None of them wanted the job of watching such a monstrosity. The Canadian soldiers outside the room stiffened when they saw Fitz headed their direction. One of them unlocked the door and let Fitz in. The soldier then closed the door and relocked it with a heavy click behind Fitz. Ace and Dohai stood in one corner, both cradling their weapons as they faced Corin.
Bars covered the windows, and heavy iron shackles were wrapped around the Chimera's ankles and wrists. Chains secured the shackles to bolts in the heavy timber floors. The half-man stared up at Fitz with narrowed yellow eyes, his breathing coming out in rasps from his slitted nostrils.
"You get some rest, boss?"
Ace asked. He tugged at his beard and leaned heavily against the wall. Fitz nodded.
"I'll take over now. You two can go get some sleep."
Ace limped out of the room, but Dohai stayed behind.
"I'm good," Dohai said.
Corin seemed unperturbed by their presence. Fitz studied him, wondering if this creature really was who he said he was, or just cooperating so the new gods could use him as a spy.
"You need the break," Fitz said. "I got this. All due respect, but I want to personally keep my eyes on this thing until Kimmer gets back," Dohai said.
The door opened again, and Fitz turned, expecting to see Ace had changed his mind, but it was Sergeant Carter Prince who walked in with two guards. "General Kamer's back," Prince said. "He's ready to talk to you if you're ready."
"We were ready last night," Dohai said.
The soldiers unlocked Corin's chains, freeing them from the bolts in the floor. They kept the chains attached to the shackles and held them like a pair of heavy leashes. Then they ushered the Chimera out. Fitz followed, keeping his rifle trained on Corin in case he tried anything. Dohai knocked on Ace's room's door. The old operator answered, his shirt already off and sleep already fogging his eyes.
"God damn it," he grumbled. "Get your clothes on. We're meeting the general," Dohai said.
Ace cursed and went back inside to change before hurrying after them. Soldiers milling about in the corridors or rushing through the base stopped and stared as the group made their way down the hall and stairwells. A few cursed under their breaths, and others turned white, pale with fear.
"Good," Fitz thought. "Let them see what awaits them."
Prince took Corin through the main lobby. A few officers stood from their desks, gawking at the monster.
"Why in the hell did you bring a variant here?" one officer asked.
"Ain't no variant," Ace said.
The officer shrank back to his desk. Most of the men and women here hadn't been on shift when Ghost had brought Corin in. The few soldiers who had seen the Chimera had been told to keep their lips sealed until General Kamer arrived. Ghost didn't want to cause a scene, just like this, before they had a chance to introduce Kamer to the Chimera. After they passed through the lobby, Prince took them to the conference room where they had first met General Kamer. Seated at the oval table in the center of the room, the general had his head down, studying some papers spread before him. A half dozen officers were gathered in the room with him, their eyes on their computers and briefing folders. Prince knocked on the door.
"Team Ghost is here to see you, sir."
"Bring them in,"
Kamer said, finally looking up. He stiffened in his seat when Fitz entered.
"You look like hell, Master Sergeant," he said.
Fitz got out of the way to let him see Corin. The general slowly rose out of his chair.
"This is the face of the new war," Fitz said. "We call them Chimeras. They're smart as humans but have all the twisted mutations of variants. And that's why we're losing."
Kamer stared for a moment, blinking a few times like he didn't believe what was standing in front of him. But if his eyes wouldn't believe it, Fitz knew his nose would. Corin stank like a rotting fish and fruit market in a blazing sun. A moment of tension passed, and to the surprise of Fitz, the first words came not out of Kamer's mouth, but out of Corin's.
"The new gods want to transform every man, woman, and child left in this world," said the Chimera. "They want to turn them into things like me."
"That's impossible," Kamer said in a shaky voice.
"It's not. And those they can't transform, they'll kill," Corin said.
Kamer looked to Fitz.
"These monsters are coming for you," Fitz said. "They're coming for all of us, whether you believe Corin or not. I've seen it with my own eyes."
"Trust me," Ace said. "It ain't pretty. And the only way to stop what's coming is to work together."
Kamer stepped from behind his table, approaching Corin cautiously.
"We nearly gave our lives to bring this monster to you," Dohai said.
Take a damn good look at him. We were wrong when we thought the human race was going to go extinct. Fitz paused, sucking in a breath that pained his agonized lungs. The abominations we fought want to force human evolution, and right now, you're looking at our future if you don't step up with your forces and team up with President Ringo.
We can hardly feed our people, Master Sergeant. How do you expect? Kamer began to say.
The Chimera growled out what sounded like a laugh.
I wouldn't worry about food. If the new gods have it their way, there won't be any human civilization left in North America by the new year.
Kamer took a few steps closer, stopping in front of the beast. For a few seconds, he said nothing. Fitz knew this general wasn't a coward. He had the scars of a veteran who had fought the beasts for almost a decade, and he had done a good job keeping his people safe. For that, Fitz respected him. But sometimes a warrior needed to see the enemy up close to understand the threat they posed, and that's exactly why Fitz had brought Corrin here. Kamer finally stepped away and sighed. He jerked his chin at a lieutenant hanging back in the shadows.
Get me President Ringgold on the phone immediately. It's time we start planning together, Kamer said.
The lieutenant hurried away. Kamer looked at Fitz, Dohai, and Ace in turn.
Thank you for risking your lives to show me the truth, he said. The Canadians are with you.
Fitz couldn't help but grin as he held out his hand to shake.
Welcome to the fight, General.
Blue Heron Audio hopes you have enjoyed our presentation of Ashes, Extinction Cycle, Book 3, by Nicholas Sansbury Smith and Anthony J. Melchiori, read by R.C. Bray. Text copyright 2019, Nicholas Sansbury Smith. Audio production copyright 2019, Nicholas Sansbury Smith. Published in arrangement with Blue Heron Audio. All rights reserved. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission from the authors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.